So first of all, yesterday's talk is already online. So if you go to the website for this series and you have the URL in various places and you click on the talk video, you can see Pedro introducing me and later me saying all sorts of nonsense things. The second point is that again, I'm following a handout, so I hope you all have a copy. I'm afraid it's at a much lower quality. So basically, when you go on a first date, you try to impress the person you're dating as much as you can, right? Wear your best clothes and all that. And then on the second date, the truth comes out. And the truth in my case is at least that my handwriting is awful. Okay? Anyway, as for content, so you know, knots should not be related to the algebra. So you know, knots are kind of squishy, right, and deformable, and sort of no symmetries at all, okay, no irregular, okay? Whereas the algebras are completely about symmetry, and if you know anything about the theory of the algebras, it's completely rigid, okay? There are A, B, C, D, E, F, G, Lie algebras, and that's it. Well, not quite, but sort of that's the core of it, okay? So knots should not be related to Lie algebras. You know, Lie algebras are from Mars and Lie algebra and knots are from Venus. They shouldn't be talking to each other. But they do. And you can ask yourself why, okay? And sort of, by now it's known for like 30 or 35 or 40 years maybe that they talk to each other. So people are not so much amazed. But if you had asked somebody 40 years ago, is there a relationship between knots and Lie algebras, they'd laugh at you. Okay, because, you know, one is from Mars, the other is from Venus. There's no reason they should be related. So I'm going to tell you today about what I think is the easiest way to see that there is a relationship. So in some sense, the natural target space for expansions for knots is the universal dual of all Lie algebras. But let me explain it, okay? But first of all, a few words about knots. So, you know, maybe I mentioned some of it yesterday, but let me just remind you. So a knot is, I don't know which side is more stable. So a knot is either an embedding of a circle to space, or sometimes you talk about several circles or various variants of it, but the basic object is an embedding of circle into space up to deformations. And alternatively, it's a function, it's a picture drawn in the plane modulo certain relations, and Rademeister's theorem says that any two plane projections represent the same knot if and only if they differ by a sequence of Rademeister 1 moves in which you undo a kink. So you have a kink and you pull it straight, or Rademeister 2 moves in which you have a situation like this and you pull it apart, or Rademeister 3 moves, which I will not do with this, but the picture is here. You basically have a crossing and you a line going behind it and you slide it through and underneath, okay? And then a knot invariant is simply a function on the space of knots. So you know, sort of the story is that the Inuits, the people from northern Canada, have 50 words for snow because they really, really care about snow. Mathematicians have 50 different words for the word function. Okay? So, you know, mapping, operator, transformation, I don't know what else. Invariant is simply a function on the space of knots. That's all. Okay? But when we say invariant, what we really mean is that it should be computable in simple terms from the presentation of a knot as a knot diagram, as a planar projection. it should take values in some space in which it is very easy to tell whether things are the same or not. So for example, polynomials in variable z with integer coefficients, okay? And it should be invariant, it should not change when you do these moves. So then it descends to the quotient and it becomes just a function of the space of knots. Okay? Now, example. So maybe the simplest example of a knot invariant is the so-called Conway polynomial, or one of the simplest examples is the Conway polynomial. And I will not prove to you that the definition I'm about to describe is well-defined, but it is enough to compute, okay? So basically, it is defined by the following. If you have a knot with a crossing, which is a positive crossing, so how to tell that this is positive? There is some right-hand rule, right? You hold the upper strand or one of the strands with your right hand so that the finger points in, so that the thumb points in one direction and then the fingers point in some other direction. Again, it doesn't really matter, but this is a so-called positive crossing. And if you evaluate the Conway polynomial on a knot that has a positive crossing, and you compare it with the Conway polynomial evaluated on the same knot except with that particular crossing replaced by a negative crossing, you get z times the Conway polynomial of what you get by replacing this entire local picture by a picture like this, a so-called smoothing. Now note that by doing this change, the number of components may change. So in fact, will change. So instead of having a knot, you may be getting a two-component thing. So the Conway, right, a two-component thing is a thing like this, right? And the Conway polynomial is really an invariant of links. So knots with an arbitrary number of components, okay? And then the second part of the definition is that if you look at a link with k unknotted components, so basically k copies of the unknotted circle, here is two, then you get one if k is equal to one, and zero if k is greater than one, okay? And then it's clear that from these two rules, the Conway polynomial is fully defined. Because, or you can compute it on every knot. Because given any knot or link, complicated as it may be, you can always undo it by a sequence of crossing changes, right? You can always unknot it if the lines are allowed to pass through each other, you can undo any knot, okay? So by a sequence of crossing changes, you can undo the knot until you get to a union of disconnected circles, and then you know the value. Now, every time you try to reverse a crossing, you have to pay a price, because the difference between an over and an under is what's written on the right-hand side. So you have to pay a price, but the price is the Conway polynomial of a link with one crossing less, which by induction you've computed yesterday. Okay, so you can then compute it by the same procedure. Okay, so that's the Conway polynomial, and if you want a lovely exercise, then you know banks, it turns out, love knots, so pick your favorite bank, and look at the logo, you'll see a knot, many times, not always. Okay, we were just having this discussion coming in, so a bank of some Portuguese bank and some Brazilian bank, and there are many others. Here's for an example, and compute the Conway polynomial of that bank. Okay, now if you're lazy, you can write a computer program, and I think Pedro was referring to it yesterday, so you can write a computer, or rather you can load a computer program, and then write a little script that will print the Conway polynomials and print the knots and their polynomials for all knots with up to 7 crossings. And first of all, you see how kind of irregular knots are. There seems to be no pattern. And secondly, here are the Conway polynomials. So for example, the interlinked logo has Conway polynomial 1 minus 3z squared plus z to the fourth, if you believe my program. Okay? Anyway, now let's try to be a bit systematic about knot invariants, and in a minute I will tell you what are polynomial knot invariants. Okay? So first of all, every knot invariant, whenever you have a knot invariant V, which is a function on the set of knots, with values in some abelian group A, polynomials, numbers, I don't know, something. Okay? You can always extend it to knots with double points. So a knot with a double point is a knot in which at one point the strand intersects itself, and then we indicate it by sort of a solid bullet. Okay? So unfortunately, you know, I cannot make one with my tools because, I don't know, but sort of if I had a welder, I could. Okay? So you can extend to a knot with double point by declaring that the value on a knot with a double point is equal to the value of the knot, of the invariant, on what you get by replacing the double point by a positive crossing, minus V evaluated on what you get when you replace the double point by a negative crossing. Okay? And you can think of it either as an analog of the things we talked about yesterday, and in fact it is precisely what we talked about yesterday in the appropriate language, which at some point I will mention. Or you can think of it as differentiating V. Because, you know, differences are essentially, or derivatives are really the values, differences of the values of the function at near neighboring points. So this is like two neighboring knots, and we compute the difference of the values of V on these two neighboring knots, so this is like differentiation. And like differentiation, you can iterate. So if you have a knot with n double points, you can take the first one, replace it by over minus under. Then take the second one, replace it by over minus under, and so on. And at the end, you'll get 2 to the n knots coming with signs. And you can sum the values of V on these 2 to the n knots with signs, and that would be the analog of the nth derivative. Okay. The moment we have So the moment we have mth differentiation, we can talk about polynomials. So a polynomial is something, a polynomial of degree m is something whose m plus first derivative is equal to 0. Okay? So we can say that V is of type m, and you should be thinking polynomial of degree m, as a function on the space of knots. If when you extend V to knots with m plus 1 double points, you always get 0. Is this okay? Are you with me? Okay. So, you know, a very lovely conjecture. So, you know, polynomials are somehow dense in the space of all functions. So the parallel of that would be that polynomials on the space of knots are dense in the space of all knot invariants. So, in particular, they should separate knots. Unfortunately, this is just a conjecture. Okay? However, there are classes of knots for which this is known. So, of knotted objects. So, the same definitions, more or less, can also be stated for braids. And for braids, this is known. By the way, I should have said that here is the picture. So the picture is you take a knot and it has 4 double points. So m is equal to 4. So 1, 2, 3, 4. And at the location of each double point, you get to choose whether to put an overcrossing or an undercrossing. And overall, you get this way 2 to the n different knots. Okay. So, example. So, the Conway polynomial that I mentioned before is not a finite type invariant of knots. Okay? However, if you expand it as a polynomial, if you look at the coefficients, then every coefficient is finite type. So if you take the Conway polynomial of a knot k, and you write it as a sum m goes from 0 to infinity of vnk times z to the m, it's a finite sum. I mean, I write up to infinity because I don't know at what degree it will stop. For different knots, the polynomial has different degrees, but it's always a finite sum. And then you look at the nth coefficient, and it is in itself an invariant of knots with values in the integers. Okay? So the claim is that this Vm, the degree m piece, is of type m. So the Conway polynomial as a whole is not of finite type, but every coefficient is. So, but if you know every coefficient of a polynomial, you know the polynomial. So all the information in the Conway polynomial is contained in finite type invariants. And you know, there is a rich theory of quantum invariants of knots. So after the Conway polynomial comes the Jones polynomial, and then the Homfli polynomial, and then various other polynomials coming from various other Lie algebras, and they all have this property. If you expand them in some parameter, so they are not of finite type, but if you expand them in some parameter, then the coefficients are finite type. So all the information is in finite type invariants. Okay? You know, this is roughly like saying e to the x is not a polynomial, but it can be approximated by polynomials. This is Taylor's theorem. So all the, so in some sense, a lot, well, what e to the x can tell, a polynomial of high degree can tell as well. Okay, anyway, here's the proof. The proof in the case of the Conway polynomial is extremely easy. So suppose you wanted to compute the Conway polynomial of a knot that has a double point. A double point is, by definition, an overcrossing minus an undercrossing. An overcrossing minus an undercrossing, by the definition of the Conway polynomial, is z times a smoothing. This I could do independently for the m plus 1 double points that I have. So I'll get that the Conway polynomial on a knot with m plus 1 double points will be z to the m plus 1 times the Conway polynomial of the thing that you get by replacing each double point by a smoothing like this. But if it starts with z to the m plus 1, right, each double point gives a factor of z, m plus 1 double points will give you a z to the m plus 1. If it starts with z to the m plus 1, the coefficient of z to the m is 0. So the mth derivative is 0, QED. Okay? Okay, so we have a definition, we think we have a conjecture about it, we have an example. Next thing is to try to find all finite type invariants. Okay, so how do you do it? You do it, well, one way to do it is like you analyze polynomials. So you know, if you have a polynomial of degree m, you differentiate it m times and you get a constant. Okay? If you know this, if two polynomials have the same m-th derivative, then they differ by a polynomial of degree one less, which you've studied yesterday by induction. So I'll do exactly the same. So if V is of type m, I want to evaluate it on knots with m, precisely m double points. And in some sense, this is like thinking of the m-th derivative of V, right? Now, if you have a knot with precisely m double points and another crossing somewhere, and you flip that crossing, the value doesn't change. Because the difference between the left-hand side and the right-hand side is v of a knot with m plus 1 double points, which is 0. Okay? So in some sense, v to the m is no longer, sorry, not v to the m, the mth derivative of v is somehow independent of the topology. Okay? You can flip crossings and nothing changes.
Okay?
So
what remains? Okay, if it doesn't depend on the topology, if you can flip crossings, what is it that remains? So what is there still in a knot with double points once you've gotten rid of the topology? So here is a knot with double points. Oh my God, now you learned something else about me. I have no clue how to draw knots. Here is a knot with double points. What remains if I don't care about how it is embedded in R3? The answer is what remains is, well, you think of yourself as an ant walking on the knot. You walk, you walk, you walk, you walk. Ooh, you notice that you've been in a double point. You walk, you walk, you walk, you walk. You notice that you've been in another double point and you have a good sense of smell, so you know it's a different one. And then you keep going and you say, oh, this is the same double point back again. The same as the first. And then you keep going and you say to yourself that I've been to the second, that you go to the second once again. So an ant walking on this knot would tell itself, I've been through point one, then I went to point two, then I went to point one, then I went to point two once again. And an easier way to indicate it is to, just the combinatorics, is to connect these things by chords and call the resulting thing a chord diagram. Right, and a chord diagram just encodes the order by which you visit the double points. This order does not change when you flip a coin, when you flip a crossing, sorry. So if you flip this crossing, it doesn't matter. Okay? And you can show that this is the only thing that remains. Okay? Once you're allowed to flip crossings. So every degree M, sorry, every type M invariant defines its nth derivative, which I will call W sub V, or it's also called a weight system sometimes, and it is a functional on chord diagrams with M chords and with values in the abelian group that you started with. Is this clear? Is this okay? Okay. So next is, well, so from every V, you get a W sub V, which is like its nth derivative, and it's a function on chord diagrams. But not all functions on chord diagrams arise in this way. There are conditions. So here's the most important condition, in some sense the only condition. So W sub V satisfies the 4T relation, and let me explain what is the 4T relation. Well, it's called 4T because it has four terms in it, and whoever named it had no imagination. But what does it say? It says that if you compute W sub V on four diagrams that look like this, now what do I mean by look like this? I mean, they have a part, well, they have three sides along the circle indicated, sort of the left, the bottom right, and the upper right. Between these three sides, there are two chords. Well, on the first diagram, there is a chord going from top to bottom, also in the second, also on the third, also on the fourth. And then on each of them, there is an additional chord starting from the left and ending either at the bottom before the vertical one, or at the bottom after the vertical one, or, well, you can, I don't need to say everything in words. And, but then in addition, there are M minus two further chords that are not shown, but are the same in all pictures. So, you know, these are these dashed lines here. So there may be another chord from here to here, and it would be the same in all four pictures. Okay? So this is not really a single relation. It's a huge family of relations, but still finite, which you obtain by taking these pictures and adding to them M minus two further chords in all possible ways, but outside the parts that are shown. Is this clear? Okay. why is this relation true? Why does it hold? So it has a very, very simple explanation. So consider a double point, and suppose you have a lasso around it. So suppose you have another piece of the knot, which comes from the bottom left and sort of wanders around it to the other side. Okay? Now, everything with, and furthermore, you have n minus 2 additional double points outside of this picture, elsewhere on the knot. Okay? Now, we're still talking about knot invariant, so I can slide this lasso under and out, and then I can slide it back in on the other side. So, V of this little picture is the same as V of that little picture, provided, you know, everything else, everything that's not shown is the same. Okay? But on the other hand, I could get from this picture to this picture by another way. Namely, I could flip this crossing from over to under, then flip this one, then flip this one, then flip this one. After four flips, I get from here to here. But every time I flip a crossing, the difference in the values of V is V evaluated on a knot with exactly M crossings, namely the M minus 2 that are outside of the picture, the one in the center, and the one that got flipped. So a sum of four flips, namely a sum of evaluations on V of V on four different places, is equal to zero. And if you look at it, it's exactly this relation. It's very easy. Is this okay? Okay. So, you know, if you want a lovely exercise, you know, everything here is real, is concrete, okay? So if you want a lovely exercise, the Conway polynomial I completely defined. I told you how to compute its m plus first derivative and show that it's zero. So compute its mth derivative, and you will get a functional on the space of core diagrams, and verify that it satisfies the 4T relation. Again, if you want an exercise, you can do it. If you want a bigger exercise, go somewhere, learn about the Jones polynomial, and do the same to the coefficients of the Jones polynomial. That's a slightly harder exercise. But anyway, now I can switch to a theorem proven by Koncievich when he was younger and looked like this. I was also younger at the time. Anyway. So, the theorem is that this is all. So, every weight system, so every W which is a function on core diagrams which satisfies the 4T relation, or alternatively, every linear functional on the space of formal linear combinations of four core diagrams modulo the subspace spanned by 4T relations. So every such W is the nth derivative of some type M invariant. So there, for every W, there is an invariant V such that W is the nth derivative of V. It's like the fundamental theorem of calculus. Every nth derivative can be differentiated, can be integrated m times. Okay? And by the way, so actually there is a small lie here. So to make it true, you have to talk about framed knots. And I don't think I want to, well, you know what, I could talk about framed knots just as well. So a framed knot is a knot that actually is a tiny ribbon. Instead of like being round, it has a tiny, it's made out of a ribbon. So, you know, I can knot ribbons just as well, right? Now, there is framed knots are essentially the same as knots. They only differ by an integer number of, by an integer parameter. There is only an extra integer parameter, which is how many times the ribbon had twisted around itself. So So the theorem becomes true when you talk about frame knots, or alternatively, if you add an additional minor relation, which I don't want to mention, which sort of corresponds to saying that changing the framing doesn't change the result. Okay? Anyway, this said, this allows you to completely compute the space, the number of finite type invariants of every type. Because if you want to know how many invariants of type M there are, they are essentially the same as the space of linear functionals on the degree M piece of A, the piece of A that has M chords. And this is just a linear space, finite dimensional linear space, because there are finitely many chord diagrams of size M, modeled out by finitely many relations. So it's an exercise in linear algebra. It's a very hard exercise because the sizes grow exponentially. But here are the numbers. So the dimension of A in degree M are given by these numbers. The dimensions of AM reduced, so reduced modulo these extra relations that I didn't mention, are given by these numbers. And so these are the numbers of framed invariants, and these are the number of unframed invariants. And PM, well, it turns out that this space A is a polynomial algebra over finitely many generators in each degree. And then these are the number of the primitives, the number of generators in each degree. But, you know, I don't know what value it has, but at least you get the sense that it's what it looks like. These are the numbers. Okay? Okay. Now, so how do you prove the Koncievich theorem? So, you construct an expansion, and let me explain. The construction is hard, and I will do it later, but let me tell you what an expansion is in this context. So the claim is that this fundamental theorem holds if and only if you can find an expansion, so a map from the space of all knots to the completion of A, so complete by allowing infinite series with rising degrees, such that if K is a knot with M double points, so Z is originally defined on ordinary knots, but it takes values in an abelian group, so it can be extended by the same way to knots with double points. So if K is an M singular knot, then Z evaluated on K is the core diagram underlying K plus higher degree terms. What's the core diagram underlying K? Well, I told you right here. If you have a two singular knot, it has an underlying core diagram, and likewise for a higher number of double points. Okay? So the theorem is you can find such a, the fundamental theorem holds if and only if there exists an expansion. Now, here is the proof. So, well, or a sketch of the proof. So, basically, Z is a map from K to A. Suppose now you have a W, so a weight system, an nth derivative. It's simply a function from A to the ground ring, to Q in this case. I should have said the theorem is over Q. Well, you compose and you get V. And it's an exercise to check that the condition written up above implies that the V that you get is of finite type and its nth derivative is the W. Okay? On the other hand, you can show that if you know for every W, if you can find a V, then that allows you to reconstruct Z. Okay? So again, I'm not showing details, but that's the spirit. Okay? And one more thing I should say is that Z is precisely an expansion in the sense of yesterday. So I don't want to review the sense of yesterday, but if you look at the planar algebra of knots, and look at the augmentation idea in it, and look at powers, then the associated graded is precisely what we call A here. And the construction of and Z is an expansion in the same sense as yesterday. Okay. Okay. So far no Lie algebra. So far we have somehow a complete or a reduction of the theory of finite type invariants to combinatorics, but it's not yet the combinatorics of Lie algebras. Now it will become the combinatorics of Lie algebras. Okay? So the next theorem, I like to call it the bracket rise theorem, because this is where the bracket arises. But I think I'm the only one in the world who does this. Okay? But anyway, what's the theorem? The theorem is that this space A, again, chord diagrams, modulo 40 relations, is isomorphic to a space of somewhat generalized chord diagrams. So these diagrams still have a circle around, but inside the circle, they may have chords like before, like this one, or like this vertical one, or like this one. But in addition, they may have internal trivalent graphs in which three internal edges, three purple edges, meet. And these graphs can become quite complicated. So here you have a sort of a four internal vertices. Okay? Now, the vertices are always trivalent. So if you see here something that looks like a vertex, but it is quadrivalent, it's not really a vertex. It's just an artifact of the projection. The object is a combinatorial graph, and I project it to the plane. It appears to have further vertices, but these vertices are not really there. Okay? Now, sorry, but that's not the complete description of the space. The space is this modulo some relations. And what are the relations? So first of all, I should have said the internal trivalent vertices are so-called oriented. So if you have a trivalent vertex, then there are three edges emanating from it. Right? If I have a vertex here, there is edge one, edge two, edge three. So to be oriented means that you specify, so each such vertex comes with a specification of a cyclic ordering of those three. And of course, there are two cyclic orderings of a triple. So one of the two is specified for each vertex. And the convention is that if I don't tell you the specification explicitly, it's just counterclockwise as drawn in the plane. Okay? So here each vertex comes with the counterclockwise orientation. And then the first relation is the so-called antisymmetry relation, which says that if you flip the orientation of a vertex, and you can do it by sort of adding a twist on top of it, you flip the sign of the you flip the sign of the whole diagram, and there is a bug in this handout because there should be a minus here. Sorry. If you twist the vertex, you get a minus sign. Sorry. And then there is the so-called STU relation, and the STU relation says that if you have a trivalent vertex connecting an edge connecting a trivalent vertex to the skeleton, which I draw in black, then this is equal to or can be replaced by a difference of two things, where in one thing you connect the upper left to the line and the upper right to the line in one order, in the other one you connect them in the opposite order. And finally, there is the IHX relation, which says that if you see the letter I anywhere within this diagram, so I can see the letter I here in many places, right? I can see the letter I here. Or, you know, I can see a sideways I in other places. Well,
Any place you see the letter I, you can replace it by H minus X. And, you know, these really stand for trivalent graphs, or pieces of trivalent graphs, but it's clear what they are. Okay? So, this is the bracket rise theorem, and the proof is actually very, very easy. Basically, I need to show two things. I need to show that these relations written here imply the 4T relation. But you see, if you have a diagram with just one trivalent vertex, and then maybe more chords that I'm not showing, you can use the STU relation, I suppose, first of all, oh my god, again I messed up. Sorry. First of all, you can use it towards the skeleton along this edge, and you get the difference between this and that. Or you can use it towards the skeleton using this edge, and you get the same thing but facing down, which is the other side of the 4T relation, and I blundered, I just wrote the same thing twice. Sorry. Okay? This is one direction. The other direction, so this tells you that the obvious map, which maps chord diagrams into this space, is well defined. The 4T is implied by these relations. But now I need to build an inverse map. So given a diagram like this, I need to reduce it to chord diagrams. But you see, if you have a diagram like this, I should have said I want the graph to be connected. Again, sorry for my forgetfulness. So you pick a vertex connected to the skeleton, you use the STU relation, and you have fewer trivalent vertices to worry about. So by induction, you can reduce any diagram like this to a linear combination of chord diagrams, and the same relation shows that it's well defined, that this process is well defined. Okay? So it's a relatively easy combinatorial theorem. Okay, next, before next, a little bit about the overall picture. So, maybe this is too philosophical. I'll go through it anyway, okay? So, we kind of have four topics playing around, and two of them we have shown. This is topology and combinatorics. And next, I want to tell you about low algebra, which is distinct from high algebra. So the next topic is low algebra. But the structure is as follows. So, topology is some space of knots or two knots or braids or some related objects. Combinatorics is the associated graded, and they are related by the attempt to find an expansion Z. Now, a priori, this space A is not necessarily interesting, but as I will show you in a minute, once you choose a Lie algebra in a representation, you can automatically get a function along this space with values in the rationals. Or, once you just choose a Lie algebra, you can get a function along this space into something called the universal enveloping algebra of that algebra. And this procedure of relating the space A to some Lie algebraic spaces is what I will call low algebra. And the only reason I want to call it low algebra is because it is lower than high algebra. High algebra is what we will do later, and it's the construction of expansions, and it's usually a very hard process of representing this using generators modulo relations and solving the equations that they imply, that they induce. Okay? So anyway, let's do low algebra, and I'll start with very low algebra. So very low algebra is given a Lie algebra in the representation thereof, I will tell you how to construct a functional on here with values here.
Okay? So, how do you do that? So, I guess even before, you can sort of see how Lie algebras could come in. So, here is the STU relation, and you can, if you label the left-hand side by X and label the, by the right-hand side by Y and do it consistently throughout, then you can think of this vertex as being a bracket. So this thing represents the bracket, this picture represents the bracket of X and Y, and then this represents the bracket, the multiplication of X and Y going from left to right. So if I trace along this edge, I see first X and then Y. So this is X times Y, this is Y times X. And this sort of says the bracket is the commutator, and that's something that you should ring a bell if you've seen Lie algebras. Also, the IHX relation, so you know, if I put here X and here Y and here Z, and here X and Y and Z in the same places, and consider the last strand, the last end as sort of an output end, then let's see what let's sort of interpret this Lie algebraically. So I go inside the diagram from the output side and I see a bracket of Z with, now I go to the left and I see the bracket of X and Y. So this can be interpreted somehow as the bracket of X and Y with Z, okay? And then likewise, this can be interpreted, so I go to the left and I see X, I go to the right, I see the bracket of Y and Z, so it's this bracket. And overall, the IHX relation looks like the Jacobi relation. So all of this completely has no meaning, it's just pictures, okay? But let's turn it into something meaningful. So more precisely, suppose G is a finite dimensional Lie algebra, with a metric, so it has a metric, an invariant symmetric non-degenerate bilinear form on it. For example, think of n by n matrices. So a simple example is G could be n by n matrices with entries in I suppose the rationals, and define the bracket of two matrices to be their commutators, commutator AB minus BA, and the metric will be the trace of their product. So the inner product of two matrices A and B will be the trace of their product. And you can check that this has all the good properties. If you know a little bit about Lie algebras, all semi-simple Lie algebras have such a metric. So the choice of this algebra G could be anything semi-simple. SON, SPN, A, B, C, D, E, F, G. Okay? Let R be a representation of the Lie algebra, so a vector space on this, on which this Lie algebra acts, finite dimensional representation with basis V sub alpha. And then the Lie algebra and its representation are completely encoded by a collection of constants, the structure constants of the Lie algebra and the matrix elements of the representation. So let me explain. So define F sub ABC to be the inner product of XA with XB, sorry, take the bracket of XA and XB, that's again an element of the Lie algebra, and take its inner product with C, with XC. And similarly, you can look at XA acting on V beta, and the result is a linear combination of V gamma, so let the coefficients be R, A, beta, gamma. Okay? I have typos. I apologize. Anyway, with these constants in place, I can construct a linear functional on these diagrams that I described before, so-called Jacobi diagrams, as follows. So given such a diagram, you mark every internal edge, so every chord or internal edge, with a letter from the Latin alphabet, lowercase letter from the Latin alphabet. If you run out of them, you start adding subscripts. Okay? And you mark every edge of the skeleton with a Greek letter, so alpha, beta, gamma. And then you map this diagram to the sum over all possible choices of A, B, and C running over from 1 to the dimension of the Lie algebra, and alpha, beta, gamma running from 1 to the dimension of the representation. And the summand is the product, or a product of factors, which you read off the diagram as follows. So around every internal trivalent vertex, there are three Latin letters. So you take the structure constants with these three Latin letters around it. So if here you have ABC, you'll take the structure constants with letters with subscript ABC. And around every skeleton vertex, you have two Greek letters and one Latin letter. So you take the corresponding matrix element of the representation. So RA beta gamma for this one you get R beta gamma alpha, so R beta gamma alpha, and so on. And of course I could have done the same even if the diagram was much more complicated, like this one. Here I'll have many, many Latin letters, A, B, C, D, E, F, G, H, you know, and so on, and a few more Greek letters as well, alpha, beta, gamma, delta, epsilon, and so on. And then each vertex will correspond to a copy of the structure constants, and each internal vertex, and each skeleton vertex will correspond to a copy of the representation matrix. Okay. Now, with this definition, this becomes a reality. So it's a simple matter to check that, well, the Jacobi identity is really an identity about applying the bracket twice. So it's some quadratic relation involving the structure constants, the FABCs. And it's easy to check that if you apply this procedure to these three diagrams, you get precisely this quadratic relation between the structure constants. Okay? And likewise, the STU relation follows from the fact that representations represent, that the bracket of two elements is the commutator of their representatives. So if you want an exercise, so again, this is completely abstract, but if you want an exercise, turn it to something concrete. It takes time, but you can find completely combinatorial, simple-minded algorithms for every specific Lie algebra you can think of. So, for example, if you take the n by n matrices with this bracket and this inner product, you can find an algorithm to compute the weight system on an arbitrary Jacobi diagram, and to compute W sub G, G and R on an arbitrary chord diagram. And if you want an exercise, relate this with the Conway polynomial, which you solved before. Okay? Good. So this is very low algebra. Now I want to move on to slightly higher algebra. Okay, so C, low algebra. Okay? So first I want to define the universal enveloping algebra of a Lie algebra. So what is it? So you know, a representation is something that satisfies
rho of the bracket of x and y is equal to rho of y minus rho of y, rho of x. And this inspires the definition of the universal enveloping algebra. So the universal enveloping algebra of a Lie algebra is the non-commutative algebra, so the associative algebra generated by the Lie algebra.
So basically it means that you you allow yourself to write arbitrary words in the generators of the Lie algebra,
okay, modeled out by linearity, so it's sort of linear in every letter. But basically, it's words in the Lie algebra, modulo the relation that the one-letter word, which is the bracket of two elements of a Lie algebra, is equal to the difference of these two-letter words, namely xy minus yx. So this defines, these relations define an ideal in the space of all words, and you mod out by this ideal, and the result is still an algebra. Now, the point of the universal enveloping algebra is that every representation of the Lie algebra automatically extends to the universal, enveloping algebra. Because every representation, if you have a map from the Lie algebra, so if rho is a map from the Lie algebra into some n by n matrices, then you can just define rho on such a product to be rho of xa multiplied by rho of xb multiplied by rho of xa again, whatever the letters are that you see. And the fact that rho satisfies this relation up there implies that it descends to the universal enveloping algebra. So it satisfies this relation defining the universal enveloping algebra. So I think I want to skip the next line, but just tell you that in some sense, the theory of universal enveloping algebra is somehow universal representation theory. Because the universal enveloping algebra contains in it, well, or information about all representations of that Lie algebra. Okay? So now I can tell you about Lie algebra. So Lie algebra is the following statement. The statement is that if you look at A of, now I have to tell you a bit about a bit of new notation. So, you know, everything that I did for knots. But equally well, I could have talked about knots with two components, or three components, and five components. And the only difference would be that instead of talking about, instead of getting at the end A of a circle, which is diagrams drawn inside a circle as before, modulo some relations, if I were to talk about the knottedness of k lines, or some number of lines, I'd be getting A of a number of lines, which just means the collection of all diagrams of the form where you have a number of skeleton lines, and in between them, and I suppose I should be using a purple, or well, at least blue is a good approximation to purple. So in between them, some trivalent graph or chords like before, and then you mod out by the exact same relation. And what I claim is that given a specific Lie algebra, if you have, there is a map from A of any number of strands to the universal enveloping algebra of that algebra tensor to the number of strands. So if there are two strands, you'll get U of G tensor squared. Okay? And here is the construction. So it's essentially the same. You label every internal edge with a lowercase English letter. You don't bother to label the external edges. And now if you have a core diagram like this, or a Jacobi diagram like this, but on a skeleton with two components, you map it into the sum over all the internal labels, or you take a copy of the structure constants for each internal vertex, and then along each of the skeleton lines, you read the word in the universal enveloping algebra. So if you have here, you can see XA and then XD and then XC. So you read this word, and then down here you see X sub B followed by X sub D. So you read this word here, and you tensor these two words together, and you got an element in U of G tensor squared. Now, and this works, of course, for any n. And in some sense, A of n arrows is universal representation theory, because it somehow commonly describes elements of the universal enveloping algebra to some power for any algebra. So elements here describe elements of the universal enveloping algebra of a Lie algebra for all Lie algebras at the same time. Okay? Now, if I had a little more time, and I think I'm already a minute over time, so I'll stop quite very, very soon. But if I had a little more time, I would tell you that much of the structure, that U of G, you know, U of G carries some structures that comes from representation theory. So representations can be, there is a tensor product of representations, and correspondingly there is a coproduct on U of G, and correspondingly there is an appropriate coproduct on A, which is somehow a universalization of the coproduct of the universal enveloping algebra, and it in itself has a non-theoretic in interpretation. But I think all of this will either come later or not come at all, but at least we have seen a relationship between knots and Lie algebras. Or to summarize the relationship, so given knot theory, completely naturally arises the space A, and given a Lie algebra and a representation, you get functionals on A, and therefore not invariants. And furthermore, this A is somehow universal representation theory for all Lie algebras at the same time. I'll stop here.
Questions?
So which examples of invariants do you get for some classical Lie algebras?
So from SL2 you get the Jones polynomial. This is with the defining representation. From SL2 with higher representations, you know, higher spins, you get the so-called color Jones polynomial. From SLN you get the Homfli polynomial. From SLN with higher representations, you get, you know, what sometimes people call the colored Homfli polynomial. From this construction also extends to super Lie algebras. And if you take the super Lie algebra GL11, you get the Alexander polynomial. But it's better to get the Alexander polynomial from a four-dimensional theory, and then you can just use the two-dimensional Lie algebra. From what else? There are a few more answers, but these are the primary ones.
From SON, you get the so-called Kaufman polynomial, which is not the Kaufman bracket, it's something else. From GLN, you also get this statement that Pedro was referring to last time about the four-color theorem. So somehow the four-color theorem is somehow related to the relation under this construction between SL2 and SLN. But that's a different story. Yes?
Are there examples of invariants that do not arise in such kind of construction?
Yes and no. So, obviously there are examples of invariants that do not arise from this construction because not all invariants are of finite type. So when I said the Conway polynomial arises from this construction with such and such Lie algebra, what I really meant is that every coefficient of the Conway polynomial is the restriction of this construction to some specific degree. But, you know, if you look at the overall degree of the Conway polynomial, so, you know, a completely legitimate invariant of knots is, where are we? Here. A completely legitimate invariant of knots is you map every knot to the degree of its Conway polynomial. So this knot gets mapped to 4. This knot gets mapped to 2, and so on. Then that is not a finite type invariant. Okay? So your question decomposes, so if I interpret your question correctly, it decomposes into two questions. Okay? So one question is, do all finite type invariants, so do finite type invariants separate knots? So do all knot invariants somehow, are all knot invariants somehow dense in, sorry, are finite type invariants somehow dense in the space of all knot invariants? And this is a conjecture that I stated, and the answer is not no. The second question is, do all finite type invariants come from Lie algebras? Or more specifically, or more precisely, do all weight systems, do all linear functionals on A come from this Lie algebraic construction? And the answer is no, but it's extremely difficult and not well understood. So at some point here I had a table. So all of these 548 or more invariants up to degree 12 do come from a Lie algebra, from Lie algebras, by explicit computations. And then there is a theorem of Vogel that somewhere in degrees, in the low 20s, you can find an invariant that doesn't come from Lie algebras, but his construction again uses Lie algebras in a certain roundabout way, which is not this direct way that I described here. And it's somehow a singular construction. There is sort of a very small family of things that he constructs, and it's not known if, you know, if the majority come from Lie algebras. It's not known if his construction can be appropriately generalized and then everything would come from Lie algebras. It's a bit, well, unsettled. So, you know, if you want to view it positively, this is somehow a piece of Lie algebra theory or universal Lie algebra theory which is stronger than just Lie algebras.
Further questions? Okay, so there should be some coffee outside.